40 million. It's probably now more than 40 million Americans who don't have reasonable access to health care. And it's a number that gets tossed around a lot. And perhaps in that discussion, we tend to forget that there are people behind that number. We will try to talk a little bit this morning about who it is. Who are the uninsured? What are the consequences for them and their families? How do they go about trying to meet their need for health care? And what does it mean not just for them, but for all Americans? And our guest for the program is Susan Starr Sered. She is the research director of the Religion, Health, and Healing Initiative at the Center for the Study of World Religions at Harvard University. And she is the co-author of a recently published book, which is titled Uninsured in America. It is published by the University of California Press. Her co-author on the book, by the way, is Rushika Fernand-Pillay. He's executive director of the Harvard Interfaculty Program for Health Systems Improvement. He and she both were on this program not all that very long ago. I think, in fact, it was in August to talk about the book. She is here visiting the campus, and we're pleased that she could be here and spend some time with us to talk about this particular issue. Questions and comments are welcome. We want to make sure that people listening know that they're invited into the conversation, and all you need to do is give us a call. 333-9455 is the Champaign-Urbana number. We do also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us. So if you're listening around Illinois or Indiana, even people listening on the internet are invited to call as long as you're in the United States. That's 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. The only thing that we just ask of callers is that people just try to be brief, and we just ask that so that we can get in as many different people as possible and try and keep things moving along. But, of course, as I say, anybody who is listening is welcome to call. Thanks very much for being here.
And thank you for having me.
And I do want to mention, in case I misspoke, that in fact it was on the Afternoon Magazine with our colleague Celeste Quinn in August that you and your co-author were on the show by telephone. So it was nice to actually have you here in the studio. Let's talk about the number of uninsured. What is the number now?
That's a really good question to ask. And the number and how the number is expressed often reflects one's political opinions or social opinions. At this point, we talk about 45 million Americans who have been uninsured for the entire past year. But in fact, many Americans churn on and off insurance. They might be working at a job that offers insurance. That job ends. They don't have insurance for a while. They might move to a different state and not have insurance for a while. So if we look at the past year, there were about 60, 65 million Americans who did not have insurance at some point over the past year. So that's a pretty big number. Slicing it a different way, we can say that at any given moment, if we're looking at this moment now, 60 to 65 million Americans do not have insurance. Broadening it more, if we look at people who sometimes don't have insurance, we're talking about a third of the country. So we're not, we talk about the uninsured, it's not a bounded marginal minority. It's actually fairly normative when we talk about a third of the country being uninsured at some point recently.
One of the things that I thought I would have you talk about just a little bit here right up front was about the Health and Healing Initiative and how it is that you came to the subject of looking at a problem of lack of insurance or lack of access to health care here in the United States, because one would seem that on the face of it, if you're in a program that's called something like Study of World Religions, you might say, well, I can see how that connects, but how exactly did you come to this?
That's a really interesting question. I guess the big answer is that I think it's really important for us in the United States to reframe conversations about health coverage away from the economic framing that we're accustomed to and to frame it in ethical terms and to say, it's unethical not to make basic health care services available to everybody in our country. I became interested in this kind of convergence of religious studies and healthcare access when I, at the time, a professor of religion, was intrigued by the fact that so much religious activity around the world centers on healing. We think of the gospel stories of Jesus. Jesus was basically a healer. That's what he was doing. So I was intrigued at that meeting point between religion and healing. Obviously, as my research moved along, that remained a starting point, but my end point was much more of a kind of sociological study of what it means to be uninsured in the United States.
Yeah. And I think also part of your interest comes from having been in other countries where other industrialized countries where health care is provided for their citizens. And one of the questions you had was, well, here we come to the United States, which is the only industrialized country where it's not provided in that way. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the questions you had was, well, what are the consequences of that? Mm-hmm. And why, in fact, does it not seem that the consequence, when you talk about the numbers that you talked about earlier, why is it that the consequences don't seem to be more obvious and more serious than they are?
Well, the consequences are serious, and I think they are obvious, at least now in the post-Katrina era. You know, we got to look at a large urban area of New Orleans that has very high rates of uninsured people. And we saw that heavily the people who were left behind, who couldn't get away before the hurricane, were people who were sick and assumedly did not really have access to health care. I mean, you could certainly hear it in those interviews with the people who were stranded, how many of them were talking about being sick. That was an unhealthy population that was left behind. There are consequences. The consequences are that despite spending more money per person on health care in the United States than in any other country in the world, our life expectancy in the United States is not very good. We're not one of the healthiest countries in the world. We die substantially younger than people in other industrialized countries in Western Europe. You said something earlier about my own experiences living outside the country and how that impacts my understandings and my research. You know, the book Uninsured in America was published last spring, and I've done quite a few radio conversations and quite a few public lectures, and there's almost always somebody who says to me, but we don't want to do what Canada does. It's really bad in Canada. And very often somebody says, and I know a woman in Canada who had to wait 6 months for a mastectomy. So I don't know if there's only one woman in Canada who had to wait 6 months for the mastectomy and everyone in America knows that person, or if it's really so common. But what I like to say in response is I lived in Japan for a year and in Israel for 20 years. My four children were all born in Israel. Both countries, Japan and Israel, have universal coverage. In the 20 years that I gave birth and raised my four kids in Israel, we never had to wait for any kind of medical service. It was so easy. It was so smooth. The kids were sick. We went to the doctor. They needed medicine. It was sold at an affordable price. I think that a lot of Americans have this idea that, well, our status quo isn't so good, but oh my gosh, at least it's better than Canada where there's rationing and people have to wait. And I guess my contribution to this conversation as someone who did live abroad in another industrialized country in Israel is that maybe Canada is not the best comparison for us in the United States, and that in Israel, which is a very ethnically diverse society like the United States, universal coverage has worked extremely well.
Mm-hmm. I suppose there were people who right away would say, well, but there is one big difference between Israel and the United States is that in the United States, we have a lot more people. And they might ask the question, well, maybe in a smaller country where the population is smaller, they might say, well, maybe you can do that. But you know, when we're talking about a country as large as the United States, then maybe we have a problem.
Yeah, I don't necessarily understand why that would be the case. I think that it's possible to set up a healthcare system in the United States that offers universal coverage, but is a decentralized system. I mean, I'm trying to think of another country that would be equivalent in population size to the United States. And I guess the example that comes to mind, and this might not be a great example, but it's an interesting one to chew over, is the Soviet Union, which until the fall of the Soviet Union had, you know, a nationalized universal coverage system. And it worked reasonably well. And the evidence for that is since the fall of the Soviet Union and the disintegration of that universal nationalized healthcare system, health has become much worse in the Soviet Union. Life expectancies have become significantly lower for women, but especially for men. Things are much worse. The health outcomes are worse in the Soviet Union. So, you know, was the system of healthcare delivery during the Soviet era wonderful in the Soviet Union? No. Would that be the perfect model for the United States? Obviously not. But I think that that does offer at least a hint that it's possible to organize and administer a large-scale universal coverage system that at least is better than not having that system.
Mm-hmm. Well, in the book, I think that you address one kind of major issue, and it provides an answer to that question: why do we have a problem, and why is the system the way it is? And the issue is that here in the United States, your access to health care is coupled to your employment, which is something that nobody else does.
Almost nobody.
Almost nobody else does anywhere. So that's a real problem. And when you go to the section in the book where you talk about your recommendations, one of the things you say is that this is a problem and we have to go beyond this. You do in the book a little bit of history where you talk about why it is. Why is it that here in the United States there is this connection between your job and your health insurance?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. I mean, before World War II, very few people had health insurance. It just wasn't part of the way that health care was provided. You know, before World War II, there were lots of hospitals that were owned and run by religious organizations. There were charity hospitals. And the cost of medical care was not so high because we didn't have so much technology. You know, until the discovery of antibiotics, people died when they were sick a lot more than they do now. So our health care costs have increased because of the technology. Because we can keep people alive when they have various kinds of illnesses. So it was around the time of World War II that this started to become an issue, that there was just sort of more that doctors and hospitals can do. Healthcare costs were rising. One of the things that happened during World War II is that, unlike today when we are constantly worrying about unemployment, in World War II, it was the employers who were worried. They couldn't get enough employees because so many Americans were serving overseas. Now, the War Labor Board put a freeze on raises, so employers couldn't lure employees or keep employees by giving them more money. But the War Labor Board did allow them to offer benefits. So employers could offer benefits to their workers as a way to lure new workers or to keep the workers they had. And the important benefit that became popularized during World War II was health insurance. Once the soldiers began to return at the end of World War II from Europe and from Asia, at that point, a number of things happened, one of which was we had an entire generation of Americans who had been accustomed to having their health care provided via the U.S. military. So they had, in their young adult years, they had become accustomed to the idea that you organize your health care access in an ongoing way rather than in an emergency rushing to the closest charity hospital. But when they returned, employers again were luring people into this booming post-war economy, into the jobs, and a way to lure them was through offering health benefits. This was also a period in which unions were quite strong in the United States, and unions negotiated health benefits for their workers in many industries. So that's why we see that, particularly in the Rust Belt, in Champaign-Urbana, you're on the edges of the Rust Belt, very, very high rates of people being covered by health insurance as a benefit that was negotiated by their union. So that's the history.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Susan Sered. She's a research director of the Religion, Health, and Healing Initiative at the Center for the Study of World Religions at the Harvard Divinity School, and is the co-author of a book that was published in the spring titled Uninsured in America. It's published by the University of California Press. Questions are certainly welcome as we continue here to talk. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Just maybe I'll raise one more point that goes to the series of recommendations that you make in the book. You look at some of the efforts to deal with this problem, and some people, I think, have argued that to make a wholesale change in the system, it's too much for us to do in this country at once. So they say, well, the way to do this is to kind of chip away at the problem and deal with people who are kind of on the extreme ends of the age spectrum. We will say, well, let's make sure we try and cover the needs of children, and let's say we'll try and make sure we cover the needs of seniors. And then someday we'll get to the everybody who is in between. And you really make the argument that that kind of incremental approach just isn't going to do it.
No, I think it's nonsensical. We already cover health care for seniors. What that means is that many American men and women, by the time they qualify for Medicare, have had a chronic health problem that has been neglected for 5 or 10 years. So they enter Medicare eligibility at the age of 65 as if that's a magic number, which it isn't, our bodies develop and evolve, you know, slowly over the years, they enter Medicare eligibility with a baggage of problems that weren't taken care of in a timely manner. So that drives up the cost of Medicare services because people enter Medicare already sick. So that takes care of the later end of the age spectrum. I think it sounds very nice to cover children, and I know here in Illinois, your governor has recently said that all kids are going to be covered. You know, I certainly support any effort to extend health care coverage to anybody, so I don't want to say that I think it's a bad idea. I do want to say that I've heard from people here at the university since I arrived here all of yesterday morning that the Illinois Medicaid system is already in debt to something like the tune of $1 billion to physicians and providers around the state. And the result of that is that these providers don't want to take Medicaid patients. So, in fact, giving Medicaid eligibility to all of Illinois kids does not mean that there's a doctor who's going to be willing to see the kids. So that's an enormous issue and needs to be taken seriously. A second really important issue in terms of covering kids is that you stop being a kid at some point. I interviewed quite a few young adults who had had really good kid care coverage until they turned 18 and then they were whacked off. I interviewed here in Champaign a young woman, early childhood educator. She was diabetic. She had juvenile diabetes. Her whole life she'd been covered. But once she graduated college, she lost her. She didn't have any more coverage. That was it. She was whacked off her father's policy. She could not find a job at a daycare center that would give her health insurance. And she was just not taking her medication. So I think that's a problem with covering kids. The third problem with covering kids is if you don't cover parents, who's going to take care of these kids? If a parent is sick, I don't think that parent can be an optimal mother or an optimal father. And in fact, by covering kids and not their parents, we're setting up situations in which parents are going to be sharing their kids' medication. And I have certainly interviewed, not here in Illinois, but in other parts of the country, mothers who, quote, borrowed their kids' asthma medicine. And I can't condemn the mother for doing that. If she's having an asthma attack and can't breathe, it's certainly traumatic for her kid to see his mother turning blue. But you can't borrow medicine and then return it. By borrowing it, it means she used it and it was gone. So that dose won't be there when the kid has an asthma attack. So I think that that kind of incremental change of covering additional populations, it's better than nothing. It's not a solution.
Yeah. And just real quick here, and I have some callers I want to get to. In the course of listening to you talk, it makes me think of another of the points that you make in the book. And I think you've actually kind of touched on it, that if you have a group of people who have no access to health care or have really spotty access to health care, what they're not going to get is more routine care, more preventive care, which also will probably be the less expensive kind of care. And what will happen is they'll not get taken care of, they'll put it off, and problems won't get taken care of, they'll get sicker. So by the time they finally do get into the system somehow, then they're going to be sicker. The care that they're going to need is going to cost more money. So it may indeed be in the long run that we're going to end up spending more money than we would have if we had tried to provide the kind of more preventive sort of routine care that would have headed these problems.
There's no question that's true, and economists have documented this. I think that the case is made most clearly for diabetes, which we know has become a national epidemic among kids and among adults. When I speak to people who are working at various community organizations trying to help those who don't have health insurance access care and access the medicines that they need, the frustration that I hear is that the hardest thing to get hold of for uninsured Americans is diabetes test strips. That diabetics can get the little monitor that they need to test their blood sugar, but no one is giving away these diabetes test strips, which, they're not cheap, but they're certainly not expensive. I think they're about $1 a strip, something like that. And diabetics need to test their blood several times a day to keep their blood at the right level. And that's how their blood sugar at the right level. And that's what avoids later complications. So these little tiny plastic strips, if you're not insured, you just can't get hold of them. That means you can't regulate your diabetes. It means complications will set in. And I guess you're lucky if a really serious complication sets in, which is end-stage renal failure and you need dialysis, because then you become eligible for Medicare and the government will cover for you dialysis, which is astronomically expensive. I mean, aside from the human cost of really uncomfortable life of living on dialysis, it is astronomically expensive. We as taxpayers are paying for dialysis rather than paying for diabetes test strips, which is just mind-boggling to me.
Let's take some calls. We'll start out with someone listening this morning over in Indiana on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Hello. Very nice summation of everything, I must say. And I've heard bits and pieces of that in all these kinds of debates and stuff, but when it come right down to it, the American public is just not for nationalized medicine. I remember as a child back in the 50s, I, for some reason, in a class I said, we ought to have it so everybody can go see a doctor and not have to worry about it like they do in Europe. And I almost got tarred and feathered because that was communism. And I think that still overlays a lot. I'd like for you to speak to the sort of the PR of the whole situation.
Yeah, how
it is that we've all of a sudden got these gremlins that the rest of the world considers, you know, angels. It's always really mind-boggling me at times. I pulled out some of those reasonings you gave to people, and somehow it always comes back. Well, there's something wrong with people who don't earn money and can pay their own way.
Yeah.
And I've just more or less accepted that's how it gets pinned on the wall. Thanks a lot. Nice.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Well, I agree with you that is, you know, an American gremlin, that we have this idea that there's salvation in hard work. I think this is part of our Puritan heritage. And I think that we also have a very deep-seated cultural idea that there's something valorous in being healthy and that being sick is almost a character flaw in a way. So I do think that in the quest for providing coverage to all Americans, we are battling some very deep-seated prejudices or beliefs that probably have their roots back, you know, in the Puritans who landed on the shores of, you know, Cape Cod a few hundred years ago. But one thing that I don't quite agree with you about is that Americans are opposed to universal coverage. From what I see in the studies that are done, year after year, the big surveys show that the majority of Americans do want to have universal coverage. They don't necessarily want nationalized health care. They don't want the government being their doctor. But they want to have universal coverage in which the government is the payer, that the government makes sure that there is money available for all Americans to go to the doctor. In fact, it seems to me that the most prominent pocket of American society that's opposed to universal coverage is not social conservatives in the Midwest. It's actually our politicians in Washington. Because pretty much across the board, when we look at the demographics of who's in favor of national of having universal coverage, it's Christians and it's non-Christians and it's whites and it's blacks and it's middle class and it's working class. It's pretty much everyone except for the politicians, which, you know, I think is really a troubling.
Well, there was a time when famously it was said that the medical profession was against this. And now I think that probably a lot of doctors have changed their mind. Are there other, though, large institutional interests, the insurance industry, for example, that is opposed to it?
Yeah. Well, I think that doctors are a really good example. The American Medical Association has been the most vocal historical opponent to universal coverage. And I think in the past 10 years, physicians are beginning to see that, you know, their autonomy is being limited not by the government, but by the insurance companies, and the doctors can't practice the kind of medicine they'd like to. You know, I see in almost every issue lately of the Journal of the American Medical Association or the other big medical journals an article supporting some kind of universal coverage program. So doctors are no longer the big opponent to universal coverage. It is the insurance companies. Traditionally, it was also the pharmaceutical companies who were afraid that they would lose if there's universal coverage. Rational prices for medicines would be negotiated and they wouldn't make the kinds of, you know, astronomical profits that they now make. But I think that the new Medicare prescription coverage plan has given a real comfort to the pharmaceutical companies that they see that even when they deal with the government, they can make pots and pots of money. So at this point, I think the insurance lobby, which is one of the most powerful lobbies in Washington, is opposed to health coverage. Just, you know, the caller's feeling that, you know, when he would tell people there should be universal coverage, they would want to, you know, tar and feather him. I did some of the research for my project in northern Idaho, which is notoriously one of the most conservative parts of the country. And I just want to tell you that almost everybody I interviewed there said we should have universal coverage. They would say, I don't want the government telling me what doctor to go to. I don't want a free ride. But I want to know that when I'm sick and when my family is sick, we can get the problem taken care of. And interestingly enough, a number of the people I interviewed in northern Idaho go across the border into Canada to get health care.
Our guest, I want to introduce again, and again get some more callers. Our guest is Susan Sered. She is Research Director of the Religion, Health, and Healing Initiative at the Center for the Study of World Religions at Harvard Divinity School, and has spent a lot of time working on this subject and talking with people about it. Her book, which she co-authored, is entitled Uninsured in America, Life and Death in the Land of Opportunity. That's the subtitle. It's published by the University of California Press, came out last spring, and makes an effort to profile some people who indeed don't have access or have spotty access to care, and ask some very basic questions about who they are, why they don't have access to health care, what the consequences for them in their lives are, and ultimately what the consequences for us as a nation are of the fact that now we have this tens of millions of people who don't have access or who have spotty and irregular kind of access to health care. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And we have several other callers, and we'll go next and talk with someone who is listening in Chicago, line two. Hello.
Good morning. I have a comment and a question. I think our lack of universal health care has determined the nature of medicine in the United States, because we really don't have preventative medicine practice here. And I think that's because people cannot afford to go to a doctor at the preventative stages. And as a result of that, we also don't have a vibrant public health sector. People who go into public health usually end up running health care facilities, but not really practicing public health as it was idealized, because there is no preventative health care here. And the question is, you said that a third of the people at any one time are uninsured. How many people do you know, or has anyone looked at, are insured by Medicaid? Because it seems to me that Medicaid is really our universal health care system, and it affects, even though it's only for the most part covering most children, and most seniors at some point have to combine Medicare with Medicaid, especially if they go into a nursing facility. And, of course, employers that pay less than a living wage, like Walmart or other employers that rely on illegal aliens, are counting that their employees will use Medicaid at least to care for their children. So it seems to me that we need to separate Medicaid out of the other insurances and see what percentage of the U.S. population they're covering. And I wanted to know if you did that.
Yeah, you ask a bunch of questions that are really great questions, so I'm going to try to respond to them in order. You talked a little bit about preventive care, and that's something that, you know, is just not seen as a priority in the current system, you know, primarily because it's not very lucrative. You don't make a lot of money doing preventive care, whereas doing, you know, heroic curative care is more lucrative. As a matter of fact, to me, one of the absurdities in our current system is that we've come to see screening as preventative care. So lots of people I interview say, oh, I do get preventative care. I go for mammograms. And we have to talk in circles a whole lot to come to an understanding that a mammogram isn't preventing cancer. All that a mammogram is doing is diagnosing the cancer. So I think that what we're calling preventative medicine in the United States is heavily early screening of one kind or another. And we make almost no, what you call, true public health efforts to improve the health of whole populations. And I think that's an extremely important point. And I think that's one of the reasons that our healthcare system is so expensive, because we're getting involved too late in the process. We're getting involved after people are already sick. You asked about Medicaid, numbers of people on Medicaid. What's important to understand about Medicaid is that the eligibility thresholds vary radically from state to state. So I have some Illinois numbers, which maybe would be the most useful for you. As I recall, the caller called from Chicago. Mm-hmm. In Illinois,
that's not my question. Mm-hmm. I was really asking that when people do the numbers and mm-hmm. they count out nationally how many are uninsured, that we really also need to pull out, because quite often they mm-hmm. include people on Medicaid
they
among
do.
The insured.
Yeah, those numbers
and
are.
I think that
yeah.
should be pulled out.
Those numbers are pulled out. I mean,
okay.
when we see a number that's uninsured, people with Medicaid count as insured. They don't count as uninsured.
Right.
But if you go to the Kaiser Family Foundation website, and that's the easiest source for everyone who wants to get any statistics, national or state level statistics on healthcare coverage, www.kff, like in Frank, kff.org, real easy to navigate. And you'll see that, you know, state by state, nationally, they'll give figures for uninsured, they'll give figures for insured that are broken down by employer-sponsored coverage, Medicaid coverage, and other, which is generally individual coverage. So those figures exist. Just to finish the thought, in Illinois, 11% of non-elderly women receive health care through Medicaid. That's a fairly substantial number. But what's important to say about that number is that the women who are in this 11% of non-elderly women who receive their coverage through Medicaid, it's a shifting population. These days, very few people stay on Medicaid for long times unless they're elderly people who have Medicaid supplementally to Medicare. So these non-elderly women are constantly cycling on and off Medicaid. They're on Medicaid while they're pregnant, and then after they give birth, they're whacked off of Medicaid. They work for a while, and then they lose a job, so their income falls below a threshold. They're back on Medicaid. It's this kind of churning on and off, which means that people start, you know, procedures and don't finish them. They're given a course of medication, they take half of it, and they don't finish it. That's a real common pattern throughout the country. So I do think that your observation that folding people covered by Medicaid into the so-called insured population is a mistake, because Medicaid is not the same as employer-based health insurance.
Yes, and I think it's very interesting. We need to look at how many people employer-based actually covers, because I think it's a very small amount, even among working people. I know very many working people who can no longer afford their deductible. And so even though they have employer-provided health insurance, it's not accessible to them truly.
Yeah, I think that's a really good observation. And there's a lot of levels in which employer-based health insurance is not really working for Americans. I mean, one of which is, as you mentioned, a lot of people are working in companies where even if they're offered health insurance, the premium that they have to pay comes out to be something like 15 or 20% of their annual salary. So clearly they cannot take that insurance even if the company offers it. Recently, I've interviewed a number of people who, when I first interviewed them, when I was writing this book 3 years ago, were uninsured. They now have insurance. They have a different job. They now have insurance. But the annual deductible is too big for them to be able to afford. So they have insurance, but they can't possibly use it. If you're earning $30,000 a year and you have a $2,000 annual deductible for each family member, that insurance is really not better than no insurance. I mean, it might be helpful in a catastrophic situation. You'll still, you know, rack up a lot of debt, but it's not something that people are really going to be able to access for, you know, ongoing preventative care for management of chronic illnesses. Another, when you said that really only a minority of Americans have true employer-based health insurance, something else that's very interesting in the statistics that I find extremely distressing, the numbers that are listed in all these national surveys for Americans with employer-based health insurance, They don't distinguish between people who have their own employer's health insurance and people who have their spouse's employer's health insurance. And as you can guess, women far more than men are insured via their spouse's health insurance. In Illinois, 75% of the married individuals who are covered as, quote, dependents are women. Now, is that such a big deal? I mean, I'm covered through my husband's health insurance, and the doctor doesn't treat me any nastier than he treats my husband. If the marriage is fine, that's great. But what if we split up? I'll lose my health insurance. What if, and this is a very common scenario in the United States, the husband is a couple years older than the wife. He turns 65. He's on Medicare. She's 62, an age in which our bodies really do start to fall apart in many ways. I can say that because I'm close to that age. She now has nothing. So even this insured figure covers up the Medicaid employer-based distinction, and that one's own employment-based versus one's spouse coverage, and actual usable coverage versus coverage that is such a big deductible, you know, or copay that you can't use it. So I think your point is very, very important.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call. Just real quick, something that I wanted to have you touch on. I think there are some people who do make the argument when you talk about the uninsured. They say, well, but we do have all of these things that are supposed to take care of them. We have Medicare. We have Medicaid. We have some states that do have programs to try to provide care, and hospitals, nonprofit hospitals, are obligated to provide care to people who can't afford it. That's part of the deal they're supposed to be doing in exchange for getting the tax exemption. And of course, there are a lot of questions about how well that's honored. When you look at all of those ways that we have tried to provide a net for those people who don't have insurance, how close is that coming to actually taking care of the need?
It's not. I mean, I think that net can be really effective for someone who's educated, articulate, well-networked, and has a lot of free time to make phone calls, so can get in touch with every single service that's available. But for 99% of people who are uninsured, who are at work so they can't spend their whole day on the telephone, who are not well-networked, who are not so educated they can go to all kinds of consumer advocacy organizations and websites, it doesn't work. The hospital's obligated to take care of patients. This is something you have to be really careful about. A lot of people think that, well, hospitals have to take you. It's not true. Hospitals are required to give care to people who are in an emergency situation. So they're required to assess and stabilize. They're not required to treat. And in fact, I interviewed a number of people. One who comes to mind right now is in Texas, who went to the hospital, for example, the case that I'm thinking of, with stomach pains. And the hospital assessed and said, you have stomach cancer. Goodbye. The hospital was not obligated to treat the stomach cancer. That the definition of an emergency for hospitals is imminent death. Stomach cancer was not immediate death. It was death in a year. And of course, this man received a hefty bill for the tests that were done in the emergency room. So this is not free care in the emergency rooms. You pay for it. It's expensive. And it's only required for emergencies. Now, in terms of the hospitals being obligated by law to provide a certain amount of free care to patients, what I'm finding is that a lot of hospitals around the United States have come up with what I consider to be a scam. And this scam is that they redefine bad patient debt as charity care. So in other words, let's say I went to the hospital and I had an emergency appendectomy. You know, I have bills for that. The bills are $20,000. The hospital is billing me. You know, I work at Walmart. I certainly don't have a big salary. I'm not paying off that $20,000 debt. I keep getting letters from the hospital. I get letters from collection agencies. I get phone calls from collection agencies. I get threatened with being taken to court. At some point, the hospital decides to cut its losses, that they've been chasing me for 3 years. They can't squeeze blood out of a turnip. It's not worth paying the collection agency to go after me. I'm clearly not going to be able to cough up any money. They let that go. They then transfer that $20,000 in their ledger from the uncollected debt ledger to the free care or charity care page in the ledger. So the free care is not necessarily this wonderful, warm, fuzzy thing. Oh, you poor thing, you just lost your job. Let me help you out. It's after 2 years of harassment, the hospital giving up.
We have some other callers here. Let's go on. Stewardson is next, line number one. Hello.
Yes, hello. I just would like to make my testament of managed health care in Europe. I was there 7 years and even went to an emergency room and got stitched up. I had great care, had my annual physical. And I think the problem here is people say, oh, your taxes will go up. Well, when I returned from Europe, I had to get a job just so I could have insurance. And I can pay my insurance premium, but I can't pay my copay, so it just goes by. I mean, yes, if I have an operation, yeah, then I'll be all right. But again, I'm not any better off than that much better off than somebody that's not insured, and I would gladly pay more taxes.
Mm-hmm. I appreciate your calling. I think that it's important for these testimonies to be made over and over again to combat that. I know a woman in Canada who waited 6 months for a mastectomy story, which just seems to be told over and over again.
That's in the urban legend category.
Yeah.
It's made up.
Yeah, it sure is. Well, thank you so much for calling.
All right. Well, let's go on here to Savoy. This is the next caller, and it's line three. Hello.
Yeah, hi. Yeah, I traveled in Canada quite a bit, and we were doing some work, and I got sick. I was actually denied care. It was very difficult to find a doctor and to get treated, and it was for, it was a simple is a really bad case of the flu and everything. And it, I'll tell you what, it took an act of God by the company I was working with to get in to see a doctor.
Mm.
And it's not as pretty as you think it is up there.
Mm-hmm.
And we were up in Quebec, and they were forcing physicians to pass their French tests and all kinds of stuff like that. And I'll tell you what, they just packed up and went to Vermont.
Yeah, the Canadian system I don't think should be the model for the American system.
Yeah.
But, you know, I certainly hear a lot of complaints out of Canada, but of course I hear a lot of complaints in the United States as well.
Well, yeah, it's bad. Well, my main question was, what do you really think would be the payroll tax on this if you flipped it?
Yeah, I mean, it would probably be less than is being paid now for insurance, because the way the system is structured now, insurance companies get a profitable bite out of every medical procedure or exchange.
Yeah.
So I say cut out that for-profit middleman of insurance companies, and I think what we'll be paying will be less than what we're paying now. And the proof for that is that we are paying more than any other industrialized country.
I've seen numbers that, you know, certainly higher than the combined Social Security. So mm-hmm. I think you're talking another 25% mm-hmm. payroll tax on top of the combined mm-hmm. Social Security.
Mm-hmm.
So you're starting to approach 40-45% combined mm-hmm. just for those two taxes possibly.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well,
okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks for the
yeah.
call. So, but you don't think that it would be that much?
I don't think it would be that much, and we're paying large amounts for our insurance premiums now. I don't think we'd be paying more in payroll tax than we're paying in the combined employer-employee portions of insurance premiums.
We have about 10 minutes left. Let me just very quickly again, for anybody who might have tuned in, introduce our guest, Susan Sered. She's the research director of the Religion, Health, and Healing Initiative at the Center for the Study of World Religions at Harvard Divinity School, and has for several years now been doing research on this issue of the uninsured in America. In fact, she is the co-author of a book that's titled Uninsured in America. It came out last spring, published by the University of California Press. We have several callers, and we will try to get in as many as we can in the time that remains. And we'll go next to a caller in Peoria on line 4. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I'd just like to make a couple of comments. We spent a couple of years in England, got acquainted with some pediatricians. They said they were so glad they were practicing in England because they didn't have to worry about whether or not their parents could afford the drugs. And they said that because they don't have advanced cases or many advanced cases of children's disease, they sent their pediatricians to the U.S. to see advanced cases of childhood disease. One last comment. The Canadians that with whom we associate over the winter down in Florida are almost universally happy with their health care as compared to many Americans that we know. Just thought you might be interested in that. Well, you can call it a testimony if you want, whatever.
That's right. Really interesting. And I think that your comment about the doctors being happy is really interesting. I had a series of informal conversations with physicians in Boston who work both at one of the Harvard teaching hospitals and at the VA hospital. And to a person, they all said they like working at the VA hospital better because they're not hassling with the insurance companies all the time. You know, so when I hear Americans say, oh, Americans will never tolerate any kind of national health care system, what I like to say is we already have one. It's called the VA system. And from what I understand, most Americans are pretty supportive of the existence of the Veterans Administration health care system.
Let's talk next with someone in Coal City. This is line 2. Hello.
Yeah, hello. You know, I think you're very articulate, and I have agreed with just about everything you say. The only thing I would like to bring up a point is that, you know, if you stop and think about it, prisoners get health insurance. If you're in jail, you get health insurance. If you're on welfare, you get health insurance. If you're a Mexican and you go to the emergency room, you're going to get treatment, and that's going to be passed on to us. If you're working and you lose your job in between jobs, you could lose everything you got. And why wouldn't anybody be for health insurance? I have no idea, but I have agreed with just about everything you have to say.
Okay. Well, I certainly think it's horrible that someone who works hard and loses a job, maybe their company downsizes or the plant moves to Mexico and they find themselves unemployed for a while, loses their health insurance. I think that's horrible. But I don't necessarily think that that means that we should not be providing health care to other populations besides people who are ones that are working and lost their jobs. In fact, Mexicans who walk into hospitals are not going to get treatment. They're going to get the same assessment and stabilization with a hefty bill that anybody else who is uninsured and walks into a hospital gets. Prisons and health care coverage varies from state to state. I just interviewed a woman in Mississippi who her son's in prison, and she has to pay for him to go to the doctor. She's billed. If she doesn't pay the bills, he won't be able to see the doctor in prison. So it's not true that everyone in prisons has, you know, access to health care coverage.
We're coming to the point where we're getting really close to the end, and I'll try to get in a couple of more callers. But was there something that
I did want
to
say something? So I think what I was trying to get at here is not to bicker with you over whether prisoners are covered or not covered. What I wanted to get at here is that I think it's not helpful for us to take this little piece of the pie, which is called government assistance for access to health care, and fight over who gets crumbs out of that little piece of the pie, and to say, well, this group deserves it more than others. So this person's working, so they deserve it more than this person who's on public aid or this person who's Mexican. I think that it would be more helpful for us as a society to move the discussion to access to basic health care is a basic human right. And it's good for society, for everybody to be able to access health care. It's good for us ethically. It's good for us economically. And it's good for us in terms of health. If my child goes to school and sits in a classroom with kids who don't have access to health care, so aren't getting their shots, aren't being treated for all kinds of diseases, my kids are going to get sick too.
Yeah. It seems that we've been having this conversation. I mean, in this country, we've been having this conversation for a while now, and that we have these two fairly committed perspectives. One is the perspective that you've advocated that says we really ought to have universal coverage, that we would be better off as a country. We'd probably be healthier. We might indeed spend less money on our health care if we actually did that. And then there's the other side that continues to argue for essentially not changing things very much, continuing a kind of a private sector approach, and having people, making it possible for people to pay for their own health insurance, but expecting people to pay for their own health insurance. If we have to supplement that, we're going to do that. If we have to come up with some way to make it affordable, we're going to do that. But it's still the idea that people are going to pay for it one way or another. So here we have the two poles of the discussion, and there we've been for, I don't know how long. How does one move this past just the discussion point of view? And if you're going to advocate the kind of system that you do, if you say that's the way to go, then how do you get there?
Well, I think the change has to happen on a broad national level. I mean, this is high-level politics. But I think that we need to be building coalitions. Increasingly, small business owners are saying, this is ridiculous. I can't be in the health insurance business. I run a printing company. I run a dentist's office. What do I know about health insurance? We're increasingly now hearing large corporations saying that they can't compete with companies in Europe because they have such a big bill for health insurance for their employees. Just recently, I'm finally starting to see churches getting involved in the conversation. So I think that building broad coalitions with small business owners, with larger corporate representatives, with church organizations, to make it clear to our politicians in Washington that most Americans want universal coverage. One thing I do want to say that seems to me to be one of the things that's emerging on the horizon around the country over the past year or so, certainly in my home state of Massachusetts, there's now on the table a couple of proposals for individual mandates. In other words, people will be required by law to purchase health insurance, and if they're too poor, the government will help them purchase the health insurance. And the word that you used was affordable health insurance. So that's how it's being framed in Massachusetts. When you look at what the so-called affordable health insurance is, it's, excuse my language, I would call it crappy health insurance. It's insurance that doesn't cover everything people need to have covered, but more than that, has these big deductibles and copays. And if you're too poor to pay for good health insurance, you're going to be too poor to pay for that annual deductible and the big copays. So I don't see this, quote, individual mandate for, quote, affordable health insurance being any kind of meaningful solution. Mm-hmm.
Well, let's see if we can get one more caller. We'll go to Philo, line 3. Hello.
Oh, hello.
Yes.
Is that me?
Yes.
Yes, hi. This is an old topic. I was in intercollegiate debate in 59 and 60, and national health insurance was the debate, that topic then. And obviously, the problem now. It's the same as it was then. You can spread the risk by universal insurance, but the insurance companies like to pick their, select for profit and select only the people who aren't going to get sick. But one interesting thing is we have a Dr. Gill who is running for Congress in a district south of us, and there's going to be a fundraiser for him on January 29th down in Charleston. And he's running on a platform of universal health care. Back then, just one interesting statistic, and I'll get off the line. Back then, I can tell you the, because I remember the odd one, back then the average salary for lawyers and doctors, for lawyers it was $7,000, and for doctors it was $15,000 a year. Things have changed.
Okay. Well, we're just about the point where we've got to finish up. Any last thought that you'd like to leave with us?
Yeah, I think the last thought I'd like to leave you with, and I'm really addressing this to your listeners in Illinois, and I gather Indiana as well. This part of the country, in many ways, was the leader in fighting for good working conditions and in fighting for good benefits for workers at the large manufacturing plants that were built in through the Rust Belt and through parts of South Central Illinois and parts of Indiana. That economy has really changed. Lots of people have lost their jobs. People who used to work in manufacturing plants are now working at Walmarts. I would love to see, this old culture of defending the rights of workers really take on the issue of access to health care for these same workers who in today's economy are not working in these wonderful manufacturing jobs or working in jobs that don't give them benefits, don't give them coverage. And I would just love to see the national leadership for universal coverage coming out of Illinois and Indiana.
Well, there we will have to leave it with thanks to our guest, Susan Sered. She is the research director of the Religion, Health, and Healing Initiative at the Center for the Study of World Religions at Harvard Divinity School. She is also co-author of the book Uninsured in America, Life and Death in the Land of Opportunity. The book is published by the University of California Press. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from Horene's Pianos Plus, your Steinway piano showroom in Bloomington. Horene's Pianos Plus offers new and pre-owned pianos by Steinway & Sons, Boston by Steinway, and other fine pianos. The broadcast is also made possible with support from Awesome, holding their annual building event this Saturday from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. in the parking lot of the Orpheum Children's Science Museum at 346 North Neal in Champaign. Awesome and PACA present a day of events for children and parents, including hammering, tile, painting, and plastering, plus live demonstrations of blacksmithing. Information available at 352-5895. We're going to take a break. We'll have more Focus 580. Before, though, we'll have an update on the markets and news. Stay tuned.
The Carle Center for Rural Health and Farm Safety, a division of Carle Foundation Hospital, is proud to underwrite agricultural programming at WILL. The center helps residents of rural communities with education and training in farm safety. For more information, call 217-383-4606.
With this market update, I'm Tom Rogers. The wheat trading up so far today. December is trading at $3 a bushel on the Board of Trade, up 2.5 cents. The March contract at 3.16 1/4, up 3. Corn and beans are down, though. December corn contract at 186 3/4, down 1. March at $2.5, down 1 1/4. May is at 209 1/2, down 1. December corn for next year at 238 1/4, down 3/4.